welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and it's time we got working. It's March. Spring is just ahead. Time to re-energize, refocus, and plant seeds to grow our business. I've done due diligence and put together, I hope you'll agree, a show on new business thinking. My guest today is not only on the New York Times bestseller list this week, but he's at the forefront of business innovation. We'll also discover, or rediscover, some classic titles many top execs recommend as must-reads. Even if you're not in the mainstream of the workplace, these titles will provide thought-provoking ideas for many facets of your life. So, item one on today's agenda, page one of the book report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineered stone, and more, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And for a truly memorable gift for those special to you, consider Lifestyles Kitchens gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's, lifestyleskitchens.com. Each year, Americans start a million new businesses. Sadly, nearly 80% of which fail within the first 5 years. Under such pressure to stay alive, it's easy for entrepreneurs to get caught up in the never-ending cycle of sell it, do it, sell it, do it. This leaves them exhausted and unable to get ahead. This is a situation Mike Michalowicz was in when trying to grow his first company. And then he discovered an unlikely source of inspiration, pumpkin farmers. After reading an article about a local farmer who had dedicated his life to growing giant pumpkins, the author realized the same process could apply to growing a business. He tested the pumpkin plan on his own company and transformed it into a multi-million dollar industry leader. He shares his inspiration in The Pumpkin Plan, a simple strategy to grow a remarkable business in any field. Some tips you'll learn: plant the right seeds. Don't waste time doing different things just to please your customers. Instead, identify the thing you do better than anyone else and focus all of your attention on it. 2. Weed out the losers. In a pumpkin patch, rotten pumpkins stunt the growth of healthy ones. The same is true of customers. Find out which customers add the most value. 3. Nurture the winners. Once you figure out who your best customers are, discover their unfulfilled needs, innovate to make their wishes come true. The Pumpkin Plan, narrated by the author, guides you through unconventional strategies to help you build a truly profitable company.
You didn't start your business because you wanted to blend in, make enough to get by, and save enough to pay for your nursing home. You went into business because you wanted to grow something amazing, something that would dramatically change the quality of your life, something that could make a difference in the world. The late Steve Jobs has been lauded for his many accomplishments and innovations, and there's no doubt that Apple is one of the truly remarkable companies on the planet, thanks in large part to his vision. But his contribution goes beyond innovation. At the time of Jobs' death, Apple employed almost 47,000 people, hired thousands of subcontractors, and, by necessity or association, inspired countless entrepreneurs to create businesses that serve Apple and its customers. That is a huge contribution to our culture, one that goes way beyond how we listen to music or communicate with the world. Now that's legend. And you can grow a legendary company too. I know you already know this. You know that if you want to be wildly successful, you've got to be the most unique pumpkin in the patch. I didn't write this book to tell you that. I wrote this book to show you exactly how to grow it, to teach you a proven system that will free you from the entrepreneurial trap and create the most magnetic business in your industry. I wrote my first book, The Toilet Paper Entrepreneur, for those who want to start a business but think they lack the education, resources, momentum, expertise, and capital to do so. I wrote it for the millions of hopefuls who aren't afraid to work hard and take chances in order to reach their goals. I wrote it to empower entrepreneurs with the tools they need to succeed in the startup phase of business ownership. That book was about planting the seed. This book is about growing it. Big time. Since the release of The Toilet Paper Entrepreneur in 2008, I've talked with thousands of entrepreneurs at conferences I keynoted throughout the world, as an expert on various business television and radio programs, through discussions of articles I've written for publications both large and small, through my notably wacky blog, and face-to-face. So I know firsthand that the sobering statistics are spot on. Entrepreneurs are struggling, trapped in a never-ending cycle of sell it, do it, sell it, do it, sell it, and do it, that leaves them feeling desperate, hopeless, trapped. No matter how many all-nighters they pull, no matter how many kids' soccer games they miss, most entrepreneurs can't seem to get anywhere near the multi-million dollar mark, much less beyond it. I wrote the Pumpkin Plan for all those entrepreneurs who reached out to me and said, help, something's got to give. I wrote it for the entrepreneurs who are exhausted from an entrepreneurial dream that has turned into a real-life nightmare. I wrote it for the entrepreneurs who need a proven system to help them get over the hump and cruise to greatness. I wrote it for every entrepreneur who is committed to having a wildly successful business. And I wrote this book for every entrepreneur who wants to make a significant contribution to the world. This book holds the key to your entrepreneurial liberation. By following the Pumpkin Plan step by step, you will build a business that blows the competition away, magnetically attracts clients, and, as cliche as it sounds, finally gives you the life of your dreams. Chapter 1. A half-ton pumpkin is about to save your life.
You don't want to be that guy, Mike.
Frank, my 70-year-old business mentor, paused to make sure I was really paying attention. We'd spent all morning talking strategy, and I was so overwhelmed my head felt ready to implode. Frank's a greatest generation Regis Philbin lookalike who wears a suit every day, even in his own house. He's so unassuming, you'd never guess he's built a company worth $80 million.
We've just heard The Pumpkin Plan by Mike Michalowicz. Daniel H. Pink is the author of 5 provocative books about changing the world of work, including the long-running bestsellers A Whole New Mind and Drive. His latest book, and the one we'll discuss today, is To Sell Is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others, which offers a fresh look at the art and science of sales. Dan's last real job was in the White House, where he served from 1995 to 97 as chief speechwriter to Vice President Al Gore. Among other jobs in government, he worked as an aide to U.S. Labor Secretary Robert Reich. Daniel went Phi Beta Kappa at Northwestern University, then earned a J.D. at Yale Law School. Daniel's articles on business and technology have appeared in many publications, including The New York Times, Harvard Business Review, Fast Company, and Wired. He's provided analysis of business trends on CNN, CNBC, ABC, and NPR, and he lectures worldwide on economic transformation and the new workplace. In 2011, Thinkers 50 ranked him one of the 50 most influential business thinkers in the world. Welcome, Daniel. Thanks so much for joining us on The Book Report.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, before we get going, I know you worked for Al Gore, so did he really invent the internet?
Not to my knowledge. You know what? I think that's still in dispute.
Okay, down to business. From To Sell Is Human, I've learned that according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Stats, 1 in 9 Americans works in sales. But you believe that it's not only the 1 in 9, it's also the other 8. So we're all in sales now?
Absolutely right. If you look at what those other 8 and 9 are doing on the job, they're spending an enormous portion of their time persuading, influencing, convincing, cajoling people. They are bosses trying to get their employees to do things a different way. They are people trying to get their teammates to come to their project rather than another project. They are trying to get extra resources on the job. They're asking their boss for a raise. They're dealing with suppliers or vendors. comprehensive survey of about 7,000 adult full-time workers in the U.S., and people report that they're spending about 40% of their time on the job doing this thing that I call non-sales selling, persuading and influencing people to make an exchange, but the cash register's not ringing, no money is changing hands, it's denominated not in dollars, but in time, effort, attention, energy. And so you put it together, 1 in 9 are in sales, 8 in 9 are in non-sales sales, non-sales selling. We're all in sales now, like it or not.
And tell us why we're all in the moving business.
Well, it's the same thing. I mean, basically what we're doing is we're trying to move other people. We're trying to get them to go from point A to point B. So instead of carrying out this project this way, do it in this other way. We are school teachers trying to get kids to pay attention in class and to learn. We are healthcare professionals trying to change people's behavior so that it's more, so that it's healthier. And so at some level, a big portion of our days and lives are about trying to convince, persuade people to move, to change their behavior, to do things differently, to give up something that they have in exchange for what we have.
What is information asymmetry?
It's a huge important point. If you say to people, hey, we're all in sales now, most people kind of recoil at that. They think of sales as sleazy and slimy and dishonest and manipulative. And I think that is a relic. I think that's an old-fashioned view of sales. It's a view that is about, as you say, about information asymmetry. Most of what we know about sales comes from a world where the sellers knew a lot more than the buyers. When the sellers know a lot more than buyers, when they have that advantage of information asymmetry, the seller can rip you off. This is why we have the principle of buyer beware. Buyers had to beware because sellers knew so much more, and buyers had very few choices and no way to talk back. But that information asymmetry has changed. It's now something closer to information parity. Good example are cars. 20 years ago, you go into a Chevy dealer, the Chevy dealer is going to know a lot more about cars, a lot more about Chevys than you ever could. Now you go into a Chevy dealer, it's a different story. You can know as much about cars, as much about Chevys, maybe even more than that car salesperson. You can know what other Chevy dealers in the area, you know, in wherever you are, in whether you're in, you know, Los Angeles or Miami or Washington, D.C., you can know what they're charging, those other dealers are charging for cars. You can go find the factory invoice price of the car. So in a world where sellers have an information advantage, that's a world of buyer beware. In a world where there's equality between buyer and seller, that's a world of seller beware. Sellers are on notice, and as a result, they have to draw on some very different qualities from the old-fashioned, outdated, plaid sport coat, always be closing form of sales.
All right. And talking about always be closing, you say that there are the new ABCs of sales. Tell us about them.
Right. The if you go to the social science and say, if we buy this idea that we're all in sales now, but sales isn't what it used to be, how do you get better at this? And so to answer that question, I went to the social science. And what it yields are three particular qualities that are most effective. They are, as you say, the new ABCs. A, attunement, B, buoyancy, C, clarity. A, attunement. Attunement is perspective taking. Can you get out of your own position and understand things from another person's perspective? And there's some really fascinating research on how to do that more effectively by reducing your power, by really understanding people's interests, by being conscious of how they physically behave. B, buoyancy. I had a salesperson say that the hardest part about being in sales is that every day you face, and this is his phrase, an ocean of rejection. So buoyancy is how do you remain afloat on that ocean of rejection? And again, there are hints about what we can do before an encounter, during an encounter, and after an encounter to remain buoyant. And the final one is C, clarity. You mentioned information asymmetry. We don't have that problem anymore. What we have is information overload. And so being able to access information is less valuable than being able to curate information, distill information, find the patterns in information. There's also a move from away from problem solving as a core skill. Problem solving still matters, but if you have a customer or a prospect who knows precisely what its problem is, They know exactly what their problem is. They can probably find a solution on their own. You're more valuable to them if they don't know what their problem is or they're confused about their problem. And so what matters more today than problem solving is problem finding, identifying problems people don't realize that they have. So these are the new ABCs, A, attunement, B, buoyancy, C, clarity. Those are the qualities that are now most effective in whether you're trying to get your kid to clean their room, whether you're trying to get your boss to give you a raise, whether you're trying to get employees to do their work a little differently.
And you also talk about the three key abilities. Tell us more about that.
Sure. So there are three kind of tactical abilities that are important, which is first is to pitch. We're pitching all the time. People are distracted. They're not paying full attention. So how do you distill your message so that it engages people and begins a conversation and interaction? Let's pitch. Improvise. What do you do when you're perfectly attuned, appropriately buoyant, super clear pitch goes awry, as it will, all the time? It turns out that the lessons of improvisational theater give us some clues about how to do that more effectively. And finally, serve. We got to get back to the point, like, what's the point of the exercise here? And I think we're moving to a world where the best approach, both in terms of best meaning ethical, but best in terms of being effective, is to serve first and sell later, to put an ethic of service and purpose at the front of what you do.
You wrote that sometimes extroverts don't make the best salespeople. That really surprised me.
Yeah, it surprised me too. This is some really fascinating research out of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. And what it showed, there's a fellow named Adam Grant, a great young scholar. And here's what he did. He went to a software company and he gave the software salespeople assessments. And those assessments located them on a introversion-extroversion scale, beginning at 1 and ending at 7. So 1 being extremely introverted, 7 being extremely extroverted. And then he charted their sales performance over the next 3 months. So what we expect is that the people who are going to be really good at sales are going to be the people very high in extroversion, the 6s and the 7s, the gregarious, glad-handing, back-slapping, hey, buddy, what can I do to put you in a Buick this afternoon kind of guys. And it turned out they were not very good, those very strong extroverts. In fact, they were barely better than the very strong introverts who, you know, are cowering in a corner and don't even want to pick up the phone. The people who did really well, though, were the people in the middle, what social psychologists call ambiverts, the people who weren't strong introverts, ones and twos, weren't strong extroverts, sixes and sevens. They were the threes, the fours, and the fives. They were a little bit introverted, a little bit extroverted. They knew when to push, they knew when to hold back. They knew when to speak up, they knew when to shut up. That they're much more attuned, much more calibrated. And so this idea that extroverts make the best salespeople is absolutely not true. There's literally no evidence of it in the literature that is true. The people who do the best are really the ambiverts, the people in the middle. And the good news is that most of us are ambiverts.
Tell our listeners about the empty chair and Amazon's Jeff Bezos.
Oh, yeah, it's a cool exercise, what he does. This is a great exercise in attunement. And something that is, I think, really useful to people. So what Bezos does, and other companies do it too, is that when he has a meeting, he'll have his marketing people, his software people, his strategy people. But when he has a meeting, he'll include at the meeting, around the table, a chair that remains empty. Interesting. An empty chair at the meeting. Why? Because that chair is there to represent the customer. And this is a really simple technique to start seeing things from your customer's point of view. So the most important person in the room is actually not in the room, the customer. And by putting that empty chair, it forces people to say, what would the customer think of what we're talking about? Would we say the sort of thing that we're about to say in front of customers? And this ends up being a really, really actionable, effective tool for all kinds of organizations, whether you're a for-profit or not-for-profit. Put an extra chair around the meeting table and have that represent the customer, and it will force you to start seeing things from the customer's point of view.
You know, what I loved about your book is that it really isn't only for salespeople and business people. I think kids, you know, entering college or going out into the workforce for the first time should read it, no matter what their profession choice would be.
Well, thanks. I'm glad to hear that. I obviously agree with you, but yeah, I think that our kids going out into the workforce, I mean, they're selling themselves. They're selling themselves in a very tough job market. And the truth is that they're going to be selling themselves for their careers. Once they get into jobs, they're going to be selling their ideas. And what we can't do is say is be so precious and say, oh, I don't do that. That's beneath me. My view is that if you really believe in yourself, if you really believe in what you've created, you actually have an obligation to sell it. You can't be so precious and say, oh, I've created this thing, and it's so awesome, people are just going to find it on their own. I think if you create something fantastic, you have something to give to the world, you have an obligation to speak up and tell people about it. You can get better at selling without being a sellout. You can get better at selling by being more human.
All right, Dan, I love this book. And as I said, I'd recommend it to anybody. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot for having me. I really appreciate it.
All righty, bye. And now let's listen to a sampling of To Sell is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others, read by the author Daniel Pink.
About a year ago, in a moment of procrastination masquerading as an act of reflection, I decided to examine how I spend my time. I opened my laptop, clicked the carefully synced color-coded calendar, and attempted to reconstruct what I'd actually done over the previous 2 weeks. I cataloged the meetings attended, trips made, meals eaten, and conference calls endured. I tried to list everything I'd read and watched, as well as all the face-to-face conversations I'd had with family, friends, and colleagues. Then I inspected 2 weeks of digital entrails, 772 sent emails, 4 blog posts, 86 tweets, about a dozen text messages. When I stepped back to assess this welter of information, a pointillist portrait of what I do and therefore in some sense who I am, the picture that stared back was a surprise. I am a salesman. I don't sell minivans in a car dealership or bound from office to office pressing cholesterol drugs on physicians. But leave aside sleep, exercise, and hygiene, and it turns out that I spend a significant portion of my days trying to coax others to part with resources. Sure, sometimes I'm trying to tempt people to purchase books I've written, but most of what I do doesn't directly make a cash register ring. In that 2 week period, I worked to convince a magazine editor to abandon a silly story idea, a prospective business partner to join forces, an organization where I volunteer to shift strategies, even an airline gate agent to switch me from a window seat to an aisle. Indeed, the vast majority of time I'm seeking resources other than money. Can I get strangers to read an article, an old friend to help me solve a problem, or my 9-year-old son to take a shower after baseball practice? You're probably not much different. Dig beneath the sprouts of your own calendar entries and examine their roots, and I suspect you'll discover something similar. Some of you no doubt are selling in the literal sense, convincing existing customers and fresh prospects to buy casualty insurance or consulting services or homemade pies at a farmer's market. But all of you are likely spending more time than you realize selling in a broader sense, pitching colleagues, persuading funders, cajoling kids. Like it or not, we're all in sales now. And most people, upon hearing this, don't like it much at all. Sales? Blech. To the smart set, sales is an endeavor that requires little intellectual throw weight, a task for slick glad-handers who skate through life on a shoeshine and a smile. To others, it's the province of dodgy characters doing slippery things, a realm where trickery and deceit get the speaking parts, while honesty and fairness watch mutely from the rafters. Still others view it as the white-collar equivalent of cleaning toilets, necessary perhaps, but unpleasant and even a bit unclean. I'm convinced we've gotten it wrong. This is an audiobook about sales.
We've just heard To Sell is Human by Daniel H. Pink. Powerful players, ruthless politicians, intrigue, and passion. In The Tangled Web, author J.P. Lane takes you on a suspense-packed global trek fraught with paid assassins and deadly plots. who will be snared in this network of murder and mayhem? Grab the Tangled Web and find out at Kindle stores and iBookstore worldwide. Reviews and more at jp-lane.com. To have any hope of succeeding as a manager, you need to get your people all in. Whether you manage a small team or a multinational, it's your job to get your people to buy into your ideas. In All In, no, not Paula Broadwell's book about General Porteous. It's All In, How the Best Managers Create a Culture of Belief and Drive Big Results. Best-selling authors Adrian Gostick and Chester Elton answer the most overlooked leadership question of our day. Why are some managers able to get their employees to push wholeheartedly for results? How can managers build and sustain a profitable, vibrant work culture? The authors, along with a top research firm, analyzed an unprecedented 300,000-person study. They made a groundbreaking finding. Managers of the highest-performing work groups create a culture of belief. Employees are not only engaged, but energized and enabled. The three E's resulted in average annual revenues three times higher than organizations lacking a positive culture. Based on their extensive consulting experience and in-depth interviews with leaders and employees at exceptional companies, the authors who narrate present a simple seven-step roadmap for creating a culture of belief.
Employee engagement scores haven't improved much at most organizations after many years of effort. And companies aren't seeing markedly greater amounts of innovation or employee initiative. As hard as managers have been working, something's missing. It's culture. Whether you manage the smallest of teams or a multi-continent organization, you are the proud owner of a culture. Congratulations. And it's important to understand that the effectiveness of that culture will have a big impact on your performance. If your culture is clear, positive, and strong, well, then your people will buy into your ideas and cause, and most important, will believe what they do matters and that they can make a difference. That pervasive enthusiasm and energy will spread like perfume in the atmosphere. On the other hand, if your culture is dysfunctional, chaotic, combative, or indifferent, employees will most likely spend more time thinking about why the people sitting next to them should be fired than getting fired up themselves. Now, a reader might ask why the Carrot Guys are writing a book on culture. The answer is simple. We've worked with clients on leadership issues for almost 20 years now, and hardly a week has gone by that we haven't excitedly called each other to talk about a fascinating corporate culture we've just stumbled upon. For a long time, we've believed that culture is what makes teams and organizations great. And yet no one was talking about it in popular business literature, and it seemed that no one really wanted to. Perhaps culture seemed the sole purview of CEOs and human resource departments. Unquestionably, the boss of a small IT department or regional call center wouldn't have the audacity to claim he had a culture, right? But over the last few years, something has changed. As we meet with new clients, expecting them to want us to work with them on the more focused ideas of employee recognition or teamwork, the subjects of our last two books, they keep steering the conversation back to culture. And not just their overall corporate culture. They've awoken to the fact that if the culture in their Cincinnati office isn't working, then no amount of thank yous or esprit de corps will help. They have learned that if a culture works, then everything works better. Take the case of Andrew Heath, who, when we met him, was the newly appointed president of the energy business of Rolls-Royce, one of the four sectors of the iconic British firm. Heath's face lit up as he described a business improvement team of 70 people he had led years before in the company's aerospace business. With more work than the team could reasonably achieve, he knew he needed to create a special environment where people would truly care about the success of the venture. He needed more than discretionary effort. He needed to create a culture where employees would see the problem before them as a challenge rather than something to drag them down. Heath realized he couldn't achieve the assigned goals by force of character alone. He needed to change his leadership style and engage the whole team by asking them what they thought would increase their commitment to the job, what help they needed, and what would give them greater satisfaction. They came up with ideas to pair new employees with senior people, identify training needs, present above and beyond awards for great work. In fact, a favorite became bottles of champagne, hold regular update luncheons, and so on. Unassuming things, really. But the outcome was not only increased employee ownership and dramatic business results, but also a level of camaraderie that is rare. Heath said, "We achieved more than we thought possible. The team and I had never worked so hard in our lives. It was a tough assignment, but we had such fun in the process."
We've just heard a sampling of All In by Adrian Gostick and Chester Elton. In his new book, Screw Business as Usual, Richard Branson, one of the world's most famous business leaders, argues it's time to turn capitalism upside down, to shift our values from an exclusive focus on profit to one that also cares for people, communities, and our planet. As Branson describes it, this is a book about revolution. The message is simple. Business as usual isn't working anymore. It's wrecking the planet. But business can help fix things and create a more prosperous world for all. Business can be a force for good, and by doing good, it will be good for business. Sean Pratt narrates.
Over the last few decades, as I've started up one exciting business after another, I have often thought that life and work could not get any better. In writing this book, however, I've come to realize that we've really been on a dummy run, preparing ourselves for the greatest challenge and opportunity of our lifetime. We've a chance to take a shot at really working together to turn upside down the way we approach the challenges we are facing in the world and to look at them in a brand new, entrepreneurial way. Never has there been a more exciting time for all of us to explore this next great frontier, where the boundaries between work and higher purpose are merging into one, where doing good really is good for business. In this book, I'll share some great stories about people who are already leading the way. We've learned a great deal from some of these pioneers as the Virgin Group continues its journey to transform itself into a force for good for people and for the planet. I'll also share some of our own Virgin Group stories and, I hope, help you learn from some of the many successes, and yes, we do have them at Virgin too, the occasional failure we've had along the way. First and foremost, I have written this book for the new wave of emerging entrepreneurs, as well as for existing business people who are transforming their organizations, at the same time as trying to develop a business and to make a living, trying to do more to help people and to help the planet. It reflects a vibrant and very marked sea change from the way business always used to be done, when financial profit was the only driving force. Today, people aren't afraid to say, "Screw business as usual," and show they mean it. The other day I was speaking to James Kidd, a former marketing director of Virgin Media in the UK, and he was talking about how this new attitude is wired into the next generation. Today you've got an emerging generation of young people who have a perspective that's different from the one that politicians and many industry leaders have, James said. They have a more balanced view. Just making money in order simply to give it away is out of date. There's a massive generational shift occurring that will blur the distinction between doing good and doing business. I couldn't agree more. I constantly meet a growing army of entrepreneurs around the world, and when they ask me if I have one single message which will help them, I tell them it's this. Doing good can help improve your prospects, your profits, and your business, and it can change the world. Fabio Barbosa, the chairman of the board of directors and former CEO of Santander Brazil, recently summed it up beautifully in an interview with Upsides magazine. He said, "It is becoming more and more clear that there is no incompatibility between doing business in an ethical and transparent manner and achieving good financial results. This false dilemma needs to be eliminated from business talk. Our social and environmental risk analysis at Santander has shown that, in the long run, companies with adequate environmental policies, well-defined labor relations, and a balanced relationship with the community end up achieving more consistent financial results and establishing a more attractive brand name. It is in the company's own interest to adopt corporate governance policies in line with the development of the country.
We've just heard Screw Business as Usual by Richard Branson. Seth Godin is a Book Report favorite. In this title, Tribes, We Need You to Lead Us, Godin describes a tribe as any group of people, large or small, connected to one another, a leader, and an idea. For millions of years, humans have sought out tribes, religious, ethnic, economic, or political. Now the internet has eliminated the barriers of geography, cost, and time. Blogs and social networking sites are helping existing tribes get bigger. But more important, they're enabling countless new tribes to be born. Groups of 10 or 10,000 or 10 million who care about their iPhones or a political campaign or a new way to fight global warming. And so the key question, who is going to lead us? The web can do amazing things, but it can't provide leadership. That still has to come from individuals, people like you who have a passion about something. If you think leadership is for other people, think again. Leaders come in surprising packages. They all have the desire to change things, the ability to connect a tribe, and the willingness to lead. Tribes, read by the author, opens your eyes to opportunities in leading fellow employees, customers, investors, or believers. It may not be easy, but it's easier than you think.
With a long enough crowbar, you can rip nails out of a board. With a long enough teeter-totter, you can lift a sumo wrestler off the ground. With enough leverage, you can change your company, your industry, and the world. The levers just got longer for everyone. The web and word of mouth and viruses and outsourcing and the long tail and the other factors involved in social media mean that everyone, every person, all 6 billion of us, has far more power than ever before. The king and the status quo are in big trouble. Wait. You might have glossed over what I just said. Perhaps because it's so quick, but especially because it's so challenging. What I'm saying is that one person can make a video that reaches 50 million viewers. What I'm saying is that one person can invent a pricing model that turns an industry upside down. What I'm saying is that one person, okay, what I really mean is you, has everything. Everything you need to build something far bigger than yourself. The people around you realize this, and they are ready to follow if you're ready to lead. Scott Beal's Party. Here's a simple example of a tribe enabled by new technology. Scott Beal is an impresario with a long history of innovation and leadership. His company, Laughing Squid, does everything from web hosting to t-shirts. From laser engraving to arts listings. In short, he leads an eclectic tribe. At the South by Southwest conference in 2008, Scott got tired of waiting in line to get into the Google party. So he walked down the street, found a deserted bar, grabbed some tables in the back, and fired up his cell phone. Using Twitter, he announced, "Alta Vista Party at Ginger Man." Within minutes, 8 people showed up. Shortly thereafter, 50. Then, there was a line out the door. No, it's not a political movement. Sure, it's a tribe. The energy and connection of the tribe are palpable. Multiply this effect by a million similar tribes, and now you understand what's happening. Tribes are just waiting to be turned into movements, and occasionally to stop to have a beer together. It's important to note that Twitter merely enabled the event. It didn't cause it to occur. Unless Scott had earned the respect and permission of the tribe that follows him, he would have been all alone at that bar. The party didn't take 4 minutes to organize. It took 4 years. A Brief History of the Factory, Part 1, The Beginning. Two things conspired to bring us the factory. The first is pretty obvious. Factories are efficient. Starting a factory and filling it with factory workers is a good way to make a profit. By factory, I don't necessarily mean a place with heavy machinery, greasy floors, and a din. I mean any organization that cranks out a product or a service, does it with measurable output, and tries to reduce costs as it goes. I mean any job where your boss tells you what to do and how to do it. The second reason we have factories has nothing to do with efficiency and a lot to do with human nature. Part of us wants stability. We want the absence of responsibility that a factory job can give us. The idea of, I'm doing what you told me to do, is very compelling, especially if the alternative is foraging for food or begging on the street. So when factories showed up, we ran to join them. On a recent trip I took to India, this mindset was made crystal clear. Ask almost anyone there what the perfect job would be, and the answer is working as a government bureaucrat. Not only do you have air conditioning, but you aren't even asked to take initiative. The job is steady, the pay is good, and there are no surprises. The factory is part of the fabric of our lives. It's there because it pays, and it's there because it's steady, and it's there because we want it. What you won't find in a factory is a motivated tribe making a difference. And what you won't find waiting outside the factory is a tribe of customers excited about what's to come.
That was Tribes, We Need You to Lead Us by Seth Godin. Hundreds of business books are published each year. As I researched top titles to include in this show, I found a list from U.S. News Magazine, compiled from conversations with 14 leaders from all walks of business life, from academics to entrepreneurs to corporate execs. They were asked which books were indispensable for business leaders. Many of them recommended this classic, Good to Great, Why Some Companies Make the Leap and Others Don't, by Jim Collins. How can good companies, mediocre companies, even bad companies achieve enduring greatness? Are there those that convert long-term mediocrity into long-term superiority? What are the distinguishing characteristics that cause a company to go from good to great? Collins and his research team analyzed the histories of 28 companies, discovering why some companies made the leap and others did not. They examined leadership, competence, discipline, technology, and restructuring. The author, who narrates, answers exactly what is required for greatness.
Good is the enemy of great. And that's one of the key reasons why we have so little that becomes truly great. We don't have great schools principally because we have good schools. We don't have great government principally because we have good government. Few people attain great lives in large part because it is so easy to just settle for the good life. The vast majority of companies never become great precisely because the vast majority become quite good, and therein lies much of their main problem. This became piercingly clear to me in 1996 when I was having dinner with a group of thought leaders gathered for a discussion about organizational performance. Bill Meehan, who ran the San Francisco office of McKinsey & Company, leaned over his salad and casually confided, "You know, Jim, we love Built to Last around here. You and your co-author, Jerry Porras, did a very fine job on the research and writing. Unfortunately, it's useless." I asked him to explain. "The companies you wrote about in Built to Last were, for the most part, always great," Bill Meehan said. "They never had to turn themselves from good companies into great companies. They had parents like David Packard and George Merck who shaped the character of greatness from early on. But what about the vast majority of companies that wake up partway through life and realize, hey, we're good. We're not great. I now realize that Meehan was exaggerating for effect with his useless comment, but his essential observation was correct. Truly great companies, for the most part, have always been great. And the vast majority of good companies remain just that. Good, but not great. Indeed, Meehan's comment proved to be an invaluable gift, as it planted the seed of a question that became the basis of this entire book. Namely, can a good company become a great company, and if so, how? Can good become great? Or is the disease of just being good incurable? 5 years after that fateful dinner, in writing this manuscript, we could say, without question, that good to great does happen. And we've learned much about the underlying variables that make it happen. Inspired by Bill Meehan's challenge, my research team and I embarked on a 5-year research effort, a journey to explore the inner workings of good to great. Now, to quickly grasp the concept of the project, I want you to picture a diagram. Now, you might be driving somewhere, you might be sitting at a desk, you might be running on the treadmill, but I want you to fix this picture in your brain. I want you to picture a stock chart that is broken into two halves. On the left half, it's just going sideways, right? It's just absolutely horizontal, totally flat, waffling to the side. And then there's a punctuation point, a pivot point, and bang, after a period of time, it starts to rise and climb and climb and climb and climb and climb and climb. So the left side of the page, flat. Right side of the page, climbing, climbing, climbing at about a 45-degree angle. And I'd like you to picture a second curve, which is a curve that tracks the flat curve for the first half of the page. But then, in comparison to when the good to great curve shoots upward, the second curve continues to go sideways. In other words, we were looking at companies that showed the top pattern, good performance to great performance, in contrast to other companies that showed good performance and never made it to great performance. More precisely, we identified companies that made the leap from good results to great results and sustained those results for at least 15 years. We then compared these companies to a carefully selected control group of comparison companies that failed to make that leap, or if they did make a leap, they failed to sustain it. We then compared the good to great companies to the comparison companies to discover the essential and distinguishing factors at work. The good to great examples that made the final cut into the study attained extraordinary results during the years of their leap, averaging cumulative stock returns 6.9 times the general market in the 15 years following their transition point.
That was Good to Great by Jim Collins. The Tipping Point, How Little Things Can Make a Big Difference, best-selling author Malcolm Gladwell looks at why changes in society happen suddenly and unexpectedly. Just as a single sick person can start an epidemic of the flu, so too can a few fare beaters and graffiti artists fuel a subway crime wave. These are social epidemics, and the moment they take off and reach their critical mass is the tipping point. Gladwell, who narrates, uncovers the personality types who are natural pollinators of new ideas and trends. He analyzes trends for clues about making ideas infectious. The Tipping Point is an intellectual adventure story with an infectious enthusiasm for the power and joy of new ideas. Most of all, it's a roadmap to change, with a profoundly hopeful message that one imaginative person applying a well-placed lever can move the world.
Police officers who served in Brownsville in the 1980s and early 1990s say that in those years, as soon as the sun went down, their radios exploded with chatter between beat officers and their dispatchers over every conceivable kind of violent and dangerous crime. In 1992, there were 2,154 murders in New York City and 626,182 serious crimes, with the weight of those crimes falling hardest in places like Brownsville and East New York. But then something strange happened. At some mysterious and critical point, the crime rate began to turn. It tipped. Within 5 years, murders had dropped 64.3% to to 770, and total crimes had fallen by almost half to 355,893. In Brownsville and East New York, the sidewalks filled up again. The bicycles came back, and old folks reappeared on the stoops. There was a time when it wasn't uncommon to hear rapid fire, like you would hear somewhere in the jungle in Vietnam, says Inspector Edward Misadri, who commands the police precinct in Brownsville. I don't hear the gunfire anymore. The New York City police will tell you that what happened in New York was that the city's policing strategies dramatically improved. Criminologists point to the decline of the crack trade and the aging of the population. Economists, meanwhile, say that the gradual improvement in the city's economy over the course of the 1990s had the effect of employing those who might otherwise have become criminals. These are the conventional explanations for the rise and fall of social problems. But in the end, none is any more satisfying than the statement that kids in the East Village caused the hush puppies revival. The changes in the drug trade, the population, and the economy are all long-term trends happening all over the country. They don't explain why crime plunged in New York City so much more than in other cities around the country, and they don't explain why it all happened in such an extraordinarily short time. As for the improvements made by the police, they are important too. But there is a puzzling gap between the scale of the changes in policing and the size of the effect on places like Brownsville and East New York. After all, crime didn't just slowly ebb in New York as conditions gradually improved. It plummeted. How can a change in a handful of economic and social indices cause murder rates to fall by two-thirds in 5 years? The tipping point is the biography of an idea, and the idea is very simple. It is that the best way to understand the emergence of fashion trends, the ebb and flow of crime waves, or for that matter, the transformation of unknown books into bestsellers, or the rise of teenage smoking, or the phenomenon of word of mouth, or any number of the other mysterious changes that mark everyday life, is to think of them as epidemics. Ideas and products and messages and behaviors spread just like viruses do. The rise of hush puppies and the fall of New York's crime rate are textbook examples of epidemics in action. Although they may sound as if they don't have very much in common, they share a basic underlying pattern. First of all, they are clear examples of contagious behavior. No one took out an advertisement and told people that the traditional hush puppies were cool and they should start wearing them. Those kids simply wore the shoes when they went to clubs or cafes or walked the streets of downtown New York, and in so doing, exposed other people to their fashion sense. They infected them with a hush puppies virus. The crime decline in New York surely happened the same way. It wasn't that some huge percentage of would-be murderers suddenly sat up in 1993 and decided not to commit any more crimes. Nor was it that the police managed magically to intervene in a huge percentage of situations that would otherwise have turned deadly. What happened is that the small number of people in the small number of situations in which the police or the new social forces had some impact started behaving very differently. And that behavior somehow spread to other would-be criminals in similar situations.
That was The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell. One Click, Jeff Bezos and the Rise of Amazon.com by Richard Brandt is a captivating look at how Amazon really works and how its founder and CEO makes it happen. Amazon's business model is deceptively simple. Make online shopping so easy and convenient, customers won't think twice. But why has Amazon been so successful? Jeff Bezos, CEO and founder, was originally a computer nerd and not a businessman. But he had the vision to capitalize on the untapped online marketplace for bookselling. He continues to discover new marketing opportunities from groceries to auto parts. He's a calculating machine, energetic, passionate, highly aggressive, and out to radically transform retail. Through numerous interviews with Amazon employees, competitors, and observers, Brandt, an award-winning journalist who's covered Silicon Valley for 2 decades, deciphers what drives Bezos and how he makes decisions. Neil Shaw narrates.
From the beginning, disaffected academics were popular because they were well-read and could supposedly help find books on a huge variety of topics. They were paid about $10 to $13 an hour, but with the potential of promotions and stock options dangled before their glazed eyes. Not everyone found nirvana in this environment. Richard Howard, for example, has a master's degree in literature, but decided to take the entry-level customer care job at Amazon in 1998 with hopes of moving into editorial, where he could write reviews of books. What he found was a work mill with 4 customer service Tier 1 email representatives to a cubicle. Supervisors listened in on calls to monitor performance and rated the workers by how many emails or phone calls they could answer per minute. Howard chronicled his experience for a Seattle newspaper in an article titled, "How I Escaped from Amazon.cult." Human interaction was treated almost as a necessary evil. Howard was given a blurb index, a list of hundreds of short, canned answers to cover virtually any question a customer might ask, which he felt were designed to create a blandly conventional zone of contact between Amazon's agents and customers. When Howard got a call from a customer one day asking how to find a copy of James Michener's Centennial, because the customer was interested in Civil War-era fiction, Howard suggested Gore Vidal's Lincoln as a better alternative. Just the type of thing a knowledgeable employee in a good bookstore might do. Howard spent 3 or 4 minutes on the call, he said, and was reprimanded by his supervisor. After 3.5 weeks on the job, he was fired for not being productive enough. He took a contract job at Microsoft instead. What the starry-eyed customer service representatives with visions of huge stock options found when starting their jobs at Amazon was long hours and options for just 100 Amazon shares, as long as they performed well for 3 years. The best could answer a dozen emails a minute. Those who dropped below 7 were often fired. The Washington Post did an exposé of this dark side of Amazon and quoted one customer service rep as saying, "We're supposed to care deeply about customers, provided we can care deeply about them at an incredible rate of speed." The customer service reps also had to learn the Unix software system the company used and had to take a 3-week training course at Amazon to learn how everything worked, including how orders for books were submitted, how they were delivered to the warehouse, how they were shelved, how to match orders to the packed books, and how to choose the best shipping method. The most frequent questions came from people who needed help ordering a book on the site or wanted to know where the book they had ordered was. But Bezos knew he would never be able to offer the kind of service one gets from a physical store staffed by human helpers. "We're never going to have sofas. We're never going to have lattes," he told Business Week magazine in June 1997. Where Bezos really managed to shine was in creating a great online experience with very little human interaction with customers. The site had to be simple, fast, and intuitive. It had to offer an unprecedented number of books at the cheapest price possible and deliver them quickly. The whole thing just had to work without problems so that people left the site happy. That seems to be enough for most people. "When we do make a customer unhappy at some point," Bezos was later to explain, "these people come out of the woodwork and say, 'Well, actually, that wasn't my experience.' Word of mouth is very powerful."
We've just heard One Click by Richard Brandt. Readers, how's that for taking care of business? Some pretty radical thinking and some fresh ideas that, when you think about them, seem like common sense. For more titles on business or pleasure, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining us today. Mark your calendars for next week when we meet again on The Book Report.